Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zael Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. There is perhaps no country in the world more perplexing and bewildering than North Korea. Considered by many as a silo shut off from the rest of the world, much of North Korea is shrouded in mystery. Unfortunately, much of that mystery involves a dictatorial regime and severe oppression of its peoples. But what exactly does it look like inside of North Korea? What are our preconceptions about North Korea? And equally important, what are the preconceptions that North Koreans might hold about the rest of the world? I'm joined today by Brandon Gauthier. Brandon joined me on a podcast last year to discuss his book, Before Evil, a look at the origin stories of some of the world's most brutal dictators. He joins me today to speak about North Korea. Brandon completed his doctorate in modern history at Fordham University in New York City in 2016. He's the director of global education at the Derryfield School and an adjunct professor of history for Fordham University. He speaks passionately and loudly. He frequently asks his students to yell, "Who cares?" and then tell him why he's wrong about everything. Before Evil, Young Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, and Kim is his first book, which was the topic of our first podcast, which I will put in the episode notes. All right, Brandon Gauthier, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me again.
Zael, such a pleasure to be back. I really, really enjoy and appreciate your podcast. So it's a great way to start a day with a cup of black coffee and with you live in conversation. So thank you for having me.
Well, thanks, Brandon. I got my coffee too, a little bit of cream in it, but we're both ready to go. So I loved our last conversation. It was so impactful to me, and I'm sure to many listeners, going over your book Before Evil. And it resonated with me just in this idea of constantly questioning yourself. Am I doing the right thing? Because none of us is immune to doing bad things, but none of us thinks we're the bad guy, as you said in the last episode. And we talked about a lot of different dictators and sort of their origin stories. And today we're going to focus on North Korea and, to an extent, the Kim dynasty, and really learn a little bit more about one of those specific examples, which you've done your thesis on this. This is your main area of research. I want to start off with a little bit of history, the origins of North Korea. How did North and South Korea become separate entities in 1945 at the end of World War II?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm going to speak maybe to begin with about how we understand North Korea, and then I'll dig specifically into the answer into that. So I think the important thing is when listeners hear North Korea, what do they think? To be direct, in one sense, we're talking about a totalitarian regime which has caused grave suffering for its people. A regime rooted in the steadfast determination of its leaders to maintain their own power. In one sense, those things are absolutely true. In another sense, North Korea is writ large a symbol in so many ways of all of our worst fears about the world. And that Korea itself, in a larger context, going back before World War II, has emerged at varying degrees, depending on the time period and depending on the moment, as a focal point of, you know, where is the world going to go from here? So before we begin to kind of discuss where does North Korea come from, it's important to note, I think, what if one was in North Korea, what they would want spoken about. And so there's going to be a tension in this interview, which is one sense I will never be someone who's not going to say the actual factual evidence about North Korea. This is a bad place. This is a bad regime. But it is a place with tens of millions of human beings, so many of whom are good people, trapped in a terrible place, all right? So in one sense, I'm going to be direct in saying the factual realities about North Korea. In another sense, we also have to endeavor to consider the meaning of North Korea beyond only simply the tyranny of its leaders, that there is an explicability to the way that North Korea views the world, the way it has made decisions. The ideological meaning of that state cannot only be reduced to the political evil of its leaders, evil, as we spoke about last conversation, being defined by a distinct lack of empathy for the consequences of one's decisions before one's own interest. So when we look at the story of Korea and how North Korea comes into being, it's important to note, I think, from a place of historical veracity, but also to lean into what a North Korean's perspective might urge. This is not only about 1945. So we immediately approach North Korea in the context of the Cold War. We immediately approach North Korea in the context of its worst crimes, which is a central part of the story. Korea, going back to 1910 and the late 19th and early 20th century, was colonized by Japan. We begin going before that to a rich, rich, rich culture with, you know, over a millenniums of history, the emergence in the story of where the Korean people come from. So we take this really, really rich culture and we see a decline of ruling Korean dynasties. You know, when we speak about Korea historically, we speak about Joseon, Goryeo, these different dynasties over the years, over the centuries. By the late 1800s, early 1900s, Korea as a power in Northeast Asia had declined dramatically and was at the mercy of its more powerful neighbors. Japan colonized Korea by 1910. And from that point onwards, the ruling Korean dynasty found itself at the mercy of foreign powers like Russia, like Japan. And one of the core points that we would hear from a Korean person's perspective north of the DMZ is that we are a country that has repeatedly been at the mercy of foreign powers that seek to exploit us for their own ends. And this is part of the story which Americans don't think about. The story of North Korea doesn't begin in 1945 with the emergence of the Cold War. This begins much earlier with an intense nationalistic resentment of foreign imperialism and foreign occupation within Korea. So the earliest story of, you know, how does North Korea come into being? How did North and South Korea come into being? Is to note that those who would be the founders of North Korea, Kim Il-sung being the preeminent leader put in place by the Soviet Union, that these were all anti-Japanese guerrillas, that they had all fought. So many of the early leaders of North Korea had fought Japanese occupation. And there's not many positive things to be said about Kim Il-sung in many respects, but he actually was a courageous guerrilla fighter that resisted Japanese imperialism and fought in Manchuria and had every reason to think he was going to die. So you ask, where does North Korea come from? We begin with the point that it's not just about the Cold War. It's about Korea's history in a larger historical context, one in which it has struggled with foreign occupation. So throughout the course of that guerrilla war against Japanese occupation, you had other leaders like Syngman Rhee, the first founder of South Korea. Someone like that was abroad speaking passionately about the need for the United States to take Korea's place in the world seriously. That what happened in Korea and this is on the eve of World War II, where the threat of ever-growing Japanese expansionism was going to be indicative of what would happen to the rest of the world. You even had someone like Isumman, Syngman Rhee, write a book in August 1941 that essentially warned the United States that it would inevitably come into conflict with Japan, that Japan would probably attack, that it was expanding its power, and that what happened to the Korean people mattered for the world. So we look at post-1945, the United States at the end of World War II, particularly in August of 1945, has dropped atomic bombs on Japan. And there's this larger question of what's going to happen to Korea, which had been occupied as a Japanese colony effectively going back to 1910 and earlier. During Japan's occupation of Korea, it had discouraged and at one point outlawed the teaching of Korean in schools, had demanded that Koreans take on Japanese names, had done everything it could to plant the seeds of an intense resentment of foreign powers on the Korean Peninsula. Franklin Delano Roosevelt had wanted to create a trusteeship, a temporary period of transition to independence for Korea, the Korean Peninsula. At the end of World War II, the United States becomes very concerned that August that you're going to have ultimately the Soviet Union potentially occupy the entire peninsula. And the United States did not have the troops or resources to immediately reach the peninsula and occupy it before the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had finally, at the end of World War II, declared war on Japan. That's the other larger historical context of this. So as with this idea in mind, that the United States did not want Korea to be fully occupied by the Soviet Union, that had within Washington, you had officials look at a map and they decided Soviet troops are pouring into Manchuria. They're approaching the Korean border. What if we just divided the Korean Peninsula into... We broached the idea to the Soviet Union, to Joseph Stalin and the Kremlin, and we have a temporary division of the peninsula. The Soviet Union occupies the north, U.S. troops occupy the south. So by September 1945, Koreans had traded one Japanese occupier for the division of their country with two new occupying powers. And at this point, you have the beginnings of what will become North and South Korea. You asked how North Korea came to be. Important point, Zale. There is no North Korea here. North Korea is not a real country. South Korea is not a real country. You'll hear this in the North, but you'll also, to some extent, hear this in the South. We speak about North Korea as if there is any historical basis to its existence. It was an arbitrary line drawn across a map. And then from then on, you essentially had the United States support its allies in the South. Neither side was willing to allow any type of genuine democratic process that might have endangered its ideological interest. Syngman Rhee, the Korean statesman I mentioned previously, becomes the leader of South Korea. And as historian Bruce Cummings has noted, in the South, the U.S. effectively embraced arch conservatives, many of whom had participated, Koreans who had participated in the Japanese occupation of their own country, had collaborated. The U.S. allied with Syngman Rhee and really arch conservatives in the South to, above all else, ensure there would be no communist regime in the South. The North, occupied by the Soviet Union, put into power Kim Il-sung, a nobody Korean fighter who was famous. His name was famous. Nobody knew what he looked like. When he first spoke in Pyongyang, the capital to be of North Korea, before like over 100,000 people, nobody recognized him. They thought he looked like a baby-faced kid. The gossip columns of history said he had a bad haircut and waddled like a duck, so to speak. Like he was a nobody. But some facts here. North Korea is established as a Soviet client state. But here's the point of complexity. The United States would view North Korea as a puppet of the Soviet Union. That wasn't fully true. The leaders of North Korea from the beginning were those, many of whom who had courageously resisted the Japanese occupation of Korea and imperialism. And they were to some extent popular in the North with many who viewed communism synonymously, whatever the contradictions of this, they viewed communism synonymously with nationalism, that those who had fought for an independent Korea had been communists, so many of them. And it was their names that ordinary people in Korea knew, Kim Il-sung, you know, the courageous hero who fights the Japanese. And Kim Il-sung had risked his life in a courageous way to fight the Japanese. The origins of North Korea begin not with a Soviet puppet state, but with a Soviet-backed client state, which places into power its allies many of whom were really popular with Koreans who viewed communism as a way to come out of colonialism, to develop the state very, very quickly as a modern state along the lines of the Soviet Union. At the same time, you had many who fled to the South. You had Koreans crossing this line every day at the 38th parallel to go south. So it is much more complicated than we want to believe. What we're seeing here emerge, though, is from the beginning of the Cold War is the notion that North Korea is emblematic in so many respects of the United States' worst fears. A puppet state of the Soviet Union that takes orders from Moscow. A puppet state that demonstrates how the Soviet Union will expand its power through increasingly using armed force to install its allies that will do the bidding of Stalin. North Korea becomes, quote unquote, North Korea, end quotes, a symbol of American fears. But, and I'm quoting a 1953 article from a conservative journal called The Freeman, North Korea, quote, is in reality nothing at all. It does not exist. It never did exist. It's not a nation. It's not a people, nor a culture, nor a naturally defined geographical region. The correct phrase would be the northern part of Korea. By an arbitrary and wholly justified line drawn on a map, this northern part was cut off from the rest of Korea. From the beginning, there has never been any, quote, North Korean government. This is just a verbal fiction like North Korea. Now we see a wild aligning of views here from the right and from North Korea's perspective. The North Korean government would say, we wholly agree. There is no North Korea. There's only Chosun. There's only the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which will come into existence a few years after 1945, the legitimate Korean government. If you go to North Korea today and you speak about North Korea, you're going to be corrected. There is no North Korea. There's only Korea. And we are the actual legitimate ancestors of those who waged a courageous anti-imperialist struggle. We are the authentic Korea. South Korea, you could say the same thing. There's no real South Korea. It's made up. That's true. It's the Republic of Korea. South Korea would say, you know, we are the legitimate Korea. So from the very beginning, we see a point of complexity that we understand North and South Korea as two separate countries. They're not. No, there is a government, the North Korean government. There are borders of North Korea, borders of South Korea, but that's not how they view themselves. Okay, so in 2010, North Korea participated in the World Cup. And this really speaks to this notion of like, what is North Korea? In their first game, they played pretty well despite being underdogs. And so North Korea was receiving some attention in the World Cup in 2010. And a reporter asked the North Korean coach about the team, how they're doing, and used North Korea. And the coach immediately cut them off and said, there is no North Korea. If you mean the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, or Chosun, I'm happy to talk about that. But there is no North Korea. Next question.
Wow.
So we begin the conversation. What is North Korea? It is an alternative vision of Korea's past, present, and future. One rooted in an extremely sensitive rejection of foreign interference into Korean affairs. The origins of a state that would become wrapped up in the tyranny of its leaders needs to be understood in that more complicated light.
That's an excellent, excellent synopsis and passionate as always. That lays the groundwork really for what I wanted to ask you next. On our last podcast, we spoke about how a lot of these dictators, contrary to an extent to popular belief, while they are bad people or did bad things and things are not black and white, but we spoke about this concept of inherent evil and how it might not really be a thing, and that a lot of the evil that arose amongst a lot of the dictators that you've studied comes back to ideology. So in terms of North Korea, a lot of people, as you said, probably view it as, yeah, it was a puppet state for Russia, for the Soviet Union, and that ideology that existed at that time and that still exists today is communism. But it sounds like that might not be true. What exactly is, if you were to speak to the Kim dynasty over the years, what is that overarching ideology that they have, and how has that guided their policies to then lead to the country that they have today?
The ruling ideology of North Korea, in one sense, is, of course, communism, right? They did embrace a Stalinist-style political and economic system that they thought would rapidly modernize their country and make it powerful and wealthy They wanted to mimic and piggyback on the communist economic style of the Soviet Union that established the Soviet Union as a world power by the end of 1945. Yet at the same time, North Korea is not only a communist political and economic state. It gets, the terms become so much more slippery because this is almost an authoritarian, fascist-like state, in the words of someone like B.R. Myers, that venerates and worships its leaders. So it is not a state that lends itself well to a simple ideological classification. From, you might look at from 1940, you know, from the end of the 1940s until 1994, you might describe this as a Stalinist state. I would feel comfortable with that ideological terminology. A radical communist state with command economy. But since the mid-1990s, when they have a horrific famine, it doesn't even really make sense to call North Korea a communist state anymore. Politically, it remains as Stalinist as ever, but economically, the economy of the country has broken down. It is a state through which many people are surviving, not through what they receive from the government in a command economy that fundamentally doesn't work, but the money that they can make on the black market through trading in a way that would be the antithesis of what the government had wanted its economy to be. So I don't have a satisfying answer for you, Zale. I would be curious to hear how others would succinctly define North Korea's ruling ideology, a Stalinist political and economic state with distinct hints of fascism and even racial nationalism. As I mentioned, B.R. Myers, a famous scholar on this, that it is a state that venerates a Korean identity as being superior to the rest of the world. So there is no easy answer on that.
And I appreciate that grayness, because I think for most countries, if you were to ask what's their ideology, it doesn't fit into a neat bucket. One of the things that I'm getting from what you're saying, though, is that there is this, to be crude, there's a hatred really for international foreign interference. A lot of that stems from the interference from Japan when they were colonizing them. And a lot of it, I imagine, also stems from the influence of the Cold War and how other countries were dictating how the country would be. Is that accurate?
The depths of enmity, the depths of hatred between the North Korean government and that of the United States cannot be understood without a deep dive into the history. I think Americans today look at North Korea and say, like, why is this such an awful place? And I would repeat, the government is awful. There are so many good people in North Korea trapped in this regime. So I don't want to demonize North Korea, so to speak, even as we're honest about the government. Okay, so let's speak about the government's perspective, the government of the DPRK and their view of the United States. The state of where that relationship is today is born a history in which North Korea has perceived itself as a tiny state that was able to throw off the yoke of Japanese imperialism and then found itself divided by foreign powers after decades of foreign occupation and imperialism. Two superpowers divide the peninsula and set them up to fight a civil war with one another. When that civil war, what we would call the Korean War or the Victorious Liberation Fatherland War, so to speak, I didn't say that correctly, that's the North Korean title for the war, that it then devastates the entire peninsula, and that North Korea is on the verge of winning that conflict until the United States intervenes and saves South Korea from being obliterated by North Korean weapons of war, which were provided by the Soviet Union. And then the United States enforces a permanent division of the peninsula at the DMZ through never letting North Korea, or South Korea for that matter, consider the possibility of renewed conflict to unite the peninsula. So North Korea has now, and South Korea, remain trapped in a quagmire of division, rooted in foreign powers imposing their will on the peninsula. That burns deep. Oh, not to mention that the Korean War saw the complete devastation of North and South Korea, that the United States firebombed almost every inch of North Korea. The depths of North Korean hatred for the United States go really, really, really deep. I don't think many Americans know very much about the Korean War, know very much about what happened. Now, okay, that's one side of the story. That's the North Korean perspective. The U.S. perspective would be ultimately that Washington was unwilling to let a Stalinist regime take root on the entire peninsula in the early years of the Cold War. So, yes, the U.S. allied with a capitalist regime, which was also oppressive in the South. And then when Stalin gave the go-ahead for Kim Il-sung to invade South Korea, the U.S. interpreted that as the puppet state moves with its master's whims and that the Soviet Union is trying to extend its control, when in reality, North Korea was trying to unify the country under Kim Il-sung. And the U.S. felt it had the obligation in a post-1938 Munich world. We don't let authoritarianism, we don't let totalitarian threats grow as we've done with Hitler in Europe. And this is one of the first hot wars of the Cold War. We have to intervene. The U.S. sends its own personnel with the United Nations to defend South Korea's right to choose its own future outside of a communist occupation. We sacrifice blood and treasure. It becomes a brutal conflict. We use extreme methods, but we save South Korea. And then we position and occupy parts of South Korea. We keep U.S. troops in South Korea for decades on end because we don't want North Korea to invade again and occupy it under a Stalinist regime. And then ultimately, South Korea has emerged as one of the U.S.'s most important trading partners, you know, has emerged as one of the world's most important economies. So we see two very different points of view. For North Korea, the United States is the ultimate boogeyman. It has devastated the Korean people. And North Korea, quote unquote, speaks to that. There is no North Korea. We're the real Korea that you continually malign and denigrate.
That's incredible historical context, especially the double perspective, one of what the North Koreans would say, which a lot of us probably do not know until you just said that, and what the Americans would say and the West would say. I want to delve into a little bit what it's like in North Korea now.
No, Zale, I'm going to stop you. No,
stop
no,
me.
Zale, we've got to go deeper into the Korean War.
Let's go into the Korean War.
And here's what I would love to do. I don't know the extent to your listeners who are like, I'm not listening for this. I want to know about North Korea today. But you cannot understand North Korea today unless you begin to appreciate how much ugliness there is between North Korea and the United States.
Take me into the Korean War.
And I just want to state, I mean, my ability to succinctly describe the complexity of this history, I state a degree of humility here, right? I need at least 6 to 7 hours to begin to do justice to the depths of this hatred. And also, I think, I don't want to say legitimacy, but an explicability of views on both sides. Zero defense of the Kim dynasty, zero apologies, or there's no being an apologist here for the ruthless leaders of North Korea. But what Americans have repeatedly failed to consider is that there is an explicable North Korean viewpoint about why North Korea hates the United States, why North Korea wanted to unify that peninsula under their control, how this relates to a much larger history that Americans fundamentally don't understand. The United States has repeatedly described North Korea as either a pawn of the Cold War, a stooge for the Soviet Union or China, which, while the Soviet Union was responsible for setting up that government in its earliest years, they did take orders from the Soviet Union. But long term, it's not true at all. The North Koreans are vehemently independent, vehemently emphatic about their own right to make their own decisions. And then two, you see North Korea described from the 1980s onwards as being somehow part of an axis of evil, to use George W. Bush's words from post 9/11, that North Korea is part of an axis of evil, that this is a state out to destroy civilization. And then the third trope is that they're crazy, you know? The North Korean leaders, these are insane people. And none of this is really fully true. North Korea has always made decisions that are explicable, that are about Korean history, as well as about maintaining the power of the leaders, and that North Korea itself and its leaders, it pains me to say it, are not insane. They are very coldly rational. Your willingness to do repugnant, unethical things does not suggest that you're insane always. It might suggest that you are willing to do heinous things for what you believe to be justifiable ends. Korean War, Zale, how about this? In the opening months of that conflict, when North Korea is racing to the southern end of the Korean Peninsula, in the first 3 weeks of that conflict, North Korea, armed with Soviet tanks and advanced Soviet weapons, note the U.S. chose to not arm South Korea with the same weapons because we thought South Korea would invade the North first. So we intentionally did not give the South heavy weapons. North Korea gets those weapons from the Soviet Union. Stalin gives the go-ahead. North Korea invades. Zale, what is the U.S. to do as it seems like South Korea might be fully occupied? the United States turns to really extreme total war methods, really extreme total war methods. We begin to firebomb anything and everything that moves that might be supporting the North Korean army. Zale, I was a doctoral student in a library where I found a dusty old book called Battle Report. And it is a history of the U.S. Navy during the Korean War. And here's a quote I found about U.S. strategy in the air during the Korean War. This is written by a naval historian, quote, about the Korean War. So we, meaning it's the U.S. military, so we, quote, killed civilians, friendly civilians, and bombed their homes, fired whole villages with the occupants, women and children, and 10 times as many hidden communist soldiers under showers of napalm. And the pilots came back to their ships, stinking of the vomit twisted from their vitals by the shock of what they had to do. The objective here was to halt and destroy an enemy whose savagery towards the people he professed to be succoring was more callous than the Nazis' campaign of terror in Poland and the Ukraine. An enemy who murdered wire-fettered prisoners of war. An enemy allowed to take his chance with death as a soldier in combat would most certainly buy a hero's niche in the heaven of his barbaric choice by taking the life of at least one American soldier. So in the Korean War, the U.S. began to ruthlessly bomb every inch of Korean territory it could that might undermine North Korean forces. North Korean soldiers, I did a lot of research on U.S. POWs taken by Chinese and North Korean forces. A frequent outcome for U.S. soldiers, as photographic evidence demonstrates, was that you would be bound behind your back with wire and then shot in the head. And so U.S. soldiers find U.S. POW shot in the head and left on roads. The extremity of the fight between North Korean and U.S. forces, it turns so, so ugly. When U.S. POWs are taken prisoner by the Chinese, they'll be grateful that it's not the North Koreans. The North Koreans are much more aggressive, and it's born of a deep resentment of U.S. involvement there. And U.S. massive bombing of civilians and military targets like is born of a deep fear of the expansion of communism. But then, you know, so the war ends, all right, by 1953. Excuse me, actually, that's not true, Zale. I'm lying to you. True or false, listeners, has the Korean War over?
No.
No, it is not. An armistice was signed. So the Korean War is not technically over. There was no peace treaty. Okay, so Korea is permanently, all but to the moment, permanently divided. And at Panmunjom, the meeting place between North and South Korea, over the years that follow, there'll still be continuous acts of sporadic violence between both sides. But U.S. and North Korean negotiators meet all the time, meet regularly at Panmunjom, at the DMZ, Truce Village. And as a doctoral student, I got to go read the transcripts of those conversations. Oh, my goodness. If you want to read what vitriol looks like. And oftentimes it happened before reporters. Okay, here's another stop on the depths of hatred between the U.S. and North Korea. In January of 1968, North Korea seized a U.S. spy ship that was off the coast of North Korea. So this is an important thing to note. The U.S. was spying on North Korea. That is a fact. The U.S. was spying on North Korea. So North Korea seized a U.S. spy ship and took some 82 prisoners. Took one crew member was killed in the process. And when the U.S. went to the DMZ to negotiate with North Korea to get our POWs back, if you will, this was the North Korean response. This is the flavor of communications between the United States and North Korea. So in the immediate aftermath of the USS Pueblo's capture, a North Korean general sat down at Panmunjom with the U.S. and North Korea sitting together. When the U.S. commander there demanded that North Korea return the sailors that were captured with the USS Pueblo, the North Korean officer says the following, quote, "A mad dog barks at the moon. What on earth do you want to get through such abusive languages? I cannot but pity you who are compelled to behave like a hooligan, disregarding even your age and honor to accomplish the crazy intentions of the war maniac Johnson for the sake of bread and dollars to keep your life. In order to sustain your life, you probably served Kennedy, who is already sent to hell, as fatefully as you are now for Johnson. If you want to escape from the same fate of Kennedy, who is now a putrid corpse, Don't indulge yourself desperately in invectives at this table as the cat's paw of Johnson. And then there were the 82 sailors who were taken captive.
Oh, my God.
Let's talk about them. Let's talk about them for a second. The U.S. sailors that were taken captive by North Korea in January 1968 from the USS Pueblo. Their commander was a guy named Lloyd Booker. Lloyd Booker, as he would later tell a U.S. naval review of admirals who wanted to know why the Pueblo didn't fight to the death. Now, when he and his men were captured off the coast of North Korea, he was ultimately brought into a room and said, "You're going to sign what we tell you to sign. You know, you are spies. You have no rights here." And Booker refuses to cooperate. They made the captain of the USS Pueblo kneel. And they said, "You have 2 minutes to confess to being a spy or we're going to shoot you." And they put a gun to his head, a pistol. The captain of that ship, Lloyd Booker, repeated, quote, "I love you, Rose. I love you, Rose. I love you, Rose." His wife's name over and over and over. The interrogator pulled the trigger. Click. Clicked harmlessly. "A misfire," the interrogator assured Booker. "Huh, it didn't work. Let's do it again. You have 2 more minutes." And then proceeded to repeat that mock execution over and over and over, saying, "This time it's real. This time we're going to kill you. Sign these papers." Not until North Korean interrogators told Lloyd Booker, "If you don't sign what we ask you to sign, we're going to take one person out of your crew, beginning with the youngest, and shoot him in front of you. You understand? You're going to sign this." And throughout the process of that, Booker was not only horrifically beaten very, very, very badly. At one point, as Booker would tell news anchor David Brinkley, when they're trying to get him to sign the confession, he was taken in a car to an isolated place, and he was brought into a room. And when he brought into that room, he saw what they said was a South Korean spy who had been tortured. The South Korean spy, the commander of the USS Pueblo, said, quote, "had a compound fracture on his right arm with a bone sticking out. He was bare from the waist down. He completely bitten through his lower lip, and the lip was hanging on the side of his mouth. His right eye was put out and his head was hanging down. And there was a lot of black matter running out of his eye, coming down his cheek. I was completely overwhelmed. I think I blacked out. I was shocked." The New York Times, as these accounts were said in an auditorium, a naval amphitheater in front of generals, and as the sailors of the USS Pueblo would recall what happened to them when they were captured by North Korea, they would say the following, that, quote, the admirals listen with puzzled expressions. Their eyes flicker or turn away as one Pueblo officer weeps about his attempt to kill himself. Another young naval officer speaks with trembling hands of the lonely terror. A third officer breaks off in mid-sentence and sinks into a morose stare. So how do we understand North Korea today? This played a big part of the American imagination. But so what is your takeaway on this? What do we make sense of the North Korean state amid these atrocities? The North Korean point of view would be, you should look at what the U.S. did during the Korean War to the Korean Peninsula. Then you'll begin to understand what suffering is. An American perspective would be, you brutally tortured. The sailors of the USS Pueblo, you have violated the most basic laws of human decency. North Korean perspective would be, because you spy on us. That happened because you were spying on us and you threaten us with weapons of war every day. Our tiny state has to stand up to this belligerent world power that repeatedly calls for our destruction. And then we would begin to think, what kind of state would do this? What kind of state would have people so brutally tortured? And I think the answer for a lot of people would be that this is an evil, evil regime of madmen. And what type of people would do this to other people? These must be, and this is the racist language used at the time, that this is a savage people. You know, these are an animalistic, savage people. This is one snapshot of how.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How the United States and North Korea misunderstand each other, that the United States amid genuine horror and actions the North Korean state is responsible for. I repeat, the North Korean state is responsible for those actions. North Korea is defined by extreme radicalism rooted in defiance of the outside world. Yeah, they have had a communist economic and political system, but the defining mantra of North Korea is this emphatic insistence on independence, not being told what to do, and its need to demonstrate that it will respond with the utmost radicalism in defending what it perceives to be its national interest. There are many, 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 many more stories like that.
I mean, those examples are beyond harrowing, and it lays the groundwork for why North Korea feels the way it does and for that isolationism that then developed.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
You said that they are not insane, that they are not crazy, and that there is a rationale, at least in their minds, not a justification, but a rationale to what they're doing. Some people listening to this would say, no, that is crazy. There is no rationale to that kind of barbaric behavior to the United States people, and we'll talk about to Korean people as well, to whom I know that the regime has shown barbarism. How would you respond to somebody who says there's no other way to view that as crazy?
I thought about that for a long time. The Pueblo example is only one. Here are a couple others. You know, it's worth noting, here's an example that in 1988, North Korean agents blew up a South Korean airliner, killing 115 people. And by the way, in October 9, 1983, North Korean agents tried to assassinate the president of South Korea with a terrorist bombing in Burma. I remember, and these are just other examples of extreme things the North Korean state, extreme and vile things the North Korean state has done. And I remember thinking for a long time, isn't blowing up airliners crazy? You know, I mean, like, actually, like, what do I mean by crazy? I mean, representative of some type of genuine mental pathology in which someone is making decisions that cannot possibly be considered rational. And so I spent a long time thinking about that. You know, and by the 1980s, Kim Jong-il, the successor to Kim Il-sung, is increasingly playing a bigger and bigger role in the North Korean government. I was like, is there any legitimacy to saying that, you know, these are insane actions? And I remember I went to a professor and I said, we have to avoid falling prey to reductive tropes that seem to like wrap all of this up in a neat package to make it all make sense, you know? But like, is this not insane to be blowing up airliners? And the professor said, it makes sense to view it that way. But by that measure, was it not insane for the U.S. to commit to more than a decade-long war in Vietnam that killed, you know, nearly 60,000 Americans, you know, that led to the death of millions of Vietnamese? Was it rational for the United States to wage war in Vietnam or Korea with such extreme weapons of war that often subjected civilians to the same type of death and destruction that it subjected enemy soldiers? What is the fine line of ideology? And that's the basis of the story. You asked, like, what is North Korea's ruling ideology? I talk about Stalinism with anti-fascism. Let's really talk about ultra-nationalism, the demand that Korea find its own way in the world. And how can this radical ideological view, what becomes a radical ideological view of the ends justifies the means, that common thread, lead states to begin to do things that in retrospect don't make any sense? You know, there's always this perspective that states make decisions because, oh, they're inherently in their best interest. You know, there's a realist appraisal of the world here. You know, the U.S. makes decisions in the Middle East or in Southeast Asia because we're going to economically benefit, you know, because the U.S. And other states, through an imperialistic critique, we're looking to benefit in terms of power and money. Who could possibly say in retrospect that that the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 benefited U.S. power and benefited the U.S. financially. Who could stay the same regardless of the heroism and service of American men and women in Afghanistan and Iraq, that those conflicts in retrospect transparently served U.S. security and financial interest? So when we talk about, is North Korea crazy? And I by no means intend to equate the actions of North Korea with U.S. foreign policy. I'm just making a point. Actions in retrospect that seem all but crazy, seem all but irrational. The use of total war methods against Vietnamese civilians in the conflict in Southeast Asia. The word crazy comes off our tongues a little bit easier than we might like to realize.
And I think what one of my takeaways that I've learned just even watching the news today is somebody can rationalize something, and I can understand someone's viewpoint of why they are doing something, but still think it's crazy. And I can understand their rationalization without justifying it and by still having utter condemnation for it. You've provided an understanding of why North Korea believes what they're doing is not crazy. And I think there's value in understanding that, as opposed to just labeling them as these guys are nuts and crazy. It's important to understand how they got there. Doesn't mean we can't condemn it as well.
Exactly. If you don't condemn it and you don't make those judgments, knowing the larger complexity of the history, even in spite of that larger complexity, there has to be a clear right and wrong at times. Even if that measure of right and wrong might oftentimes be complicated, there's no complexity about bombing airliners. This was an evil act.
You spoke a lot about North Korea and what they've done awfully to the States and to other people, to South Korea. I want to understand what they do to their people and the scale of horror that a lot of us have heard of but might not actually know within North Korea. And I don't even know how much is known, because it seems like to me the ideology in North Korea, and why a lot of us view it as a silo, has stemmed from this notion that North Korea says, no, we are not going to be overly influenced by the rest of the world. We are going to keep North Korea itself. And I'm guessing that a lot of the violence and atrocities that North Korean government has inflicted upon its people is related to anybody who's deviating and trying to be more connected to the world.
The North Korean state today remains in its mind the successors to this alternative vision of the world, of an independent Korea that lives beyond the whims or demands of the United States. North Korea today and its leaders are trapped by that history, and that the state they run is inherently, in so many respects, a failed state, even if the government still maintains its authority in that regard. And the people there are utterly trapped in a system that perpetuates extreme poverty for the interest of a tiny elite at the top who continue to benefit. And those who question that reality are going to be subject to the most merciless of punishments. And it won't only be me or you, Zale, if I was a Korean citizen north of the DMZ. It'd be your family. It'll be generational punishment. What the North Korean state demands of its people is what I remember from the end of George Orwell's 1984, an interrogation moment. And I'm going to paraphrase. Zale, if I hold up in front of you four fingers and I ask you how many fingers am I holding up, and you say four, and I correct you and I say, no, I'm holding up two fingers. And then I ask you again, how many fingers am I holding up, Zale? And you say two. And then I say, but are you saying two because you know I want you to say two? Or are you saying two because you genuinely believe it? Because I have told you that I'm holding up two fingers. The North Korean state today demands unquestioning fidelity and belief to its capital T version of truth. And those who go against that will experience punishment and misery and physical pain that's hard for us to contemplate. North Koreans are trapped in a world today in which, even if the explicability of their government, that there's a larger historical story that helps us understand it, the leaders today, in one sense, one might assume they view themselves, Kim Jong-un saying, an interview, he might say, yeah, I know my country in many respects is a nightmare, right? But we have the obligation to my father, to my grandfather, to continue this state. Nobody tells us what to do. And yet there's another really awful side of this. Kim Jong-un and his family live lives of ultra luxury. He lives a life in marble mansions and yachts, and it is rooted in the extreme oppression of his people and the exploitation of his country's resources for him and his military and his allies. Those who question that, I repeat, take a grave, grave, grave risk about what's going to happen to them. And it is a world, an Orwellian world. There's no such thing as true totalitarianism, but North Korea does well at getting pretty close. A world in which, as defectors have said in stories, you might have best friends who, after going to school all day, after attend a party meeting where we're going to study Kim Il-sungism and Kim Jong-ilism, and that, you know, we're going to have to repeat like the Bible verses out loud, because it is the religion. It is, as Christopher Hitchens described it, it's the most religious place in the world. Rest in peace, Christopher Hitchens. And we're going to repeat these verses like scripture. And we're going to sing songs of praise. And you will sing, Zale. You will sing. You put your family in danger by not playing along and doing these things, right? You must participate. You will not remain silent. You will not remain neutral, lest you imperil those you love, right? But I remember reading, you know, about best friends looking at one another across the room. And they don't say it, but you could look at your best friend in the eye and say, I know that you know that this is wrong. But we'll never be able to say it to one another. I'm not going to risk my family through talking to you about this, but I can look at you in the eye and I know that you know that this is wrong and we're trapped in this. But that's one version of it. And there's truth to that. Key point there. There are intelligent, thoughtful, wonderful people in the North trapped in that system who get that it's a state that is trapping them, who get that things are bad regardless of what the party tells them. There's also true believers. And there's also true believers indoctrinated in this cultish system since they're little kids, who sing songs of praise, starving to death, holding one's children starving, having a party official look at you in the eye and say, trust the party. Kim, our great, dear, respected leader, he loves you. He's working so hard for you every day to rest easy in the bosom of a savior, even as you starve. Because that same leader lives in yachts and mansions. Well, they never know that, so many of them. And the thought that the savior is there for them is a consoling one. Working for the church while your family dies, so to speak, to use a lyric from a song by Arcade Fire. That's North Korea. There's a million degrees of complexity to it, but that's the core truth.
It's terrifying. And as you were asking me, this is audio, but you were holding up four fingers. And as you were saying, is this two? Are you just saying it because I'm telling you to say it's two, or do you truly believe it's two? It's really terrifying, and it does have that Orwellian 1984 feel to it. It might be impossible to know because they're so secluded from the world unless you speak to defectors, though there's a bit of a bias there because a defector obviously is, to an extent, a certain type of person with a certain type of ideology. Do you have any idea how many people in North Korea really don't understand the outside world at all and don't have that insight? And if the North Korean dictatorship were to put up those four fingers and say this is two, metaphorically, would actually believe, yeah, that's two, and that they are completely, utterly brainwashed? Or is there more influence of the outside world than we realize, and a lot of North Koreans really do know what's up, but it is that fear that they just can't say anything?
I think that is the unknowable reality. So it is unknowable in the sense that we can never discern how many people in the North truly get what's happening. We can only be certain based off of defector testimony that there are so many in the North who aren't brainwashed, who are thoughtful, intelligent people, can see what's happening, can see that they're hungry. But there is, as someone like Charles Robert Jenkins, a U.S. soldier who defected to North Korea, would say he raised kids there. And he would say one of his daughters, like, clearly got, like, what was happening basically was off, even though she grew up in the system. But then he had another daughter who, like, really believed it. So we'll never know the extent to which those north of the DMZ fully understand the extent of the catastrophe that has happened to their country. But we know that there are those who get what's happening, and there are those who truly believe that the leaders are doing their best. We also need to note that over the last two decades, the border with China has been much more porous than anyone in the North Korean government would like to admit. You know, there have been USB drives. There are movies that have come over that have been smuggled in. As much as North Korea has been shut off from the world, it's hardly isolated fully from the outside world. Kim Jong-un's regime has sought to be much more aggressive in executing people who violate the bringing in of foreign material. But North Koreans, to some extent, have had glimpses of the outside world. There's a certain cognitive dissonance there of trying to ignore it and still embrace what the government tells us. But the reality is this. I think we should state, frankly, the truth about the nature of the North Korean government, that this is a vile state. This is a vile regime. I think, too, we should speak to a complexity which is hardly only the fault of the North Korean government, about the history of the country and Korea, and that there is an explicability to the North Korean perspective about Korea's history, about a fear of outside occupation, a need to fight and resist what it views as foreign imperialism. And then three, most importantly by far, we should feel a deep well of emotion for the North Korean people. We should love the North Korean people, and we should never demonize those who are trapped north of the regime, even as we would condemn those in the regime. Zayal, I remember going to the DMZ from the North Korean side, and this is a story I've said before, but I'll say it again. So I was at Panmunjom in North Korea, looking into South Korea, and a North Korean officer approached me, and in a smattering of Korean, me speaking a smattering of Korean, to respond to an intense question he asked me, you know, he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Miguk Sudaram Ieo, I'm an American." And he looked at me appalled, and he said, "You know, why are you here?" And I responded by saying, "I love the Korean people, North and South, different governments, but one people, one Korean people. And I love the Korean people." And he leaned in and he said, "How can you love us when we hate you so much?" And I responded by saying, "You should love the American people, and the American people should love the Korean people, North or South. You're welcome to hate our government, but it's wrong to hate you or your family, ordinary people in the North, you know, ordinary soldiers. I discourage that." You know, then he kind of scoffed at me and was like, you know, in his mind, probably like, "This is cute." And he pointed out an American soldier south on the U.S. on the South Korean side. You know, no, he would say, "Did you almost say the U.S. side? My point exactly." Right.
So but you were too smart for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd get slammed for that. Yeah. So then he'd point out U.S. soldiers on the South Korean side of the DMZ. And note, there is no South or North Korea, even if those countries exist in reality. It's different visions of Korea, all right? So he would say, "Why is," pointing towards South Korea, "why are there American soldiers in my country? There are, what if there were North Koreans in your country? You know, were there Koreans?" He wouldn't say North Korea. "What if there were Korean soldiers in your country? Because that's my country," pointing at the South. "And there's U.S. soldiers still occupying it." And he said, "Why do American soldiers come here to make war?" And I said in response that I understand that you would feel angry. I think there's a lot more to be said for that topic. But that soldier probably joined the U.S. Army to go to college. You know, he's probably here because he wants to go to school and has a family and probably has kids. And he's not here to make war. I have no doubt he would fight courageously or heroically, but that's not what he's here to do. I hope that when you look at him, you see someone who probably just wants money to go to college. And, you know, he said, kind of walked away. And then I got on the tour bus and I turned around. And he was like sitting right there, ready to continue the conversation. I was totally freaked out. But it was a human moment. I feel distinctly dissatisfied with the conversation in the sense that the complexity of everything we're talking about demands so much more time. It demands so much more, I think, specific historical reflection, honesty about the things that the United States has done wrong, as well as the vile things that the North Korean state has done wrong. But the one thing I would urge your listeners is to humanize North Korea as Korean people trapped in a terrible, terrible system, a product of the waves of history post 1945 and the waves of the 20th century at large. And I think about that soldier. I think about other North Koreans I met, and I worry about them. I feel I feel for them. And so I would urge people, when they think about North Korea, not just think about Kim Jong-un, think about ordinary men and women, whether they are indoctrinated and believe in the system, whether or not they get what's going on, but are still trapped by it. Who speaks for them?
Well, Brandon, I think you did a phenomenal job of explaining the situation, and I love how you ended on the humanity of it, which is ultimately what matters and what we can take away from it. I am distinctly satisfied with our conversation. Contrary to you, you've done a lifetime of research in this area, so I don't think you would ever be satisfied unless we had you on for multiple episodes, and I would love to have you back again to discuss other facets, but you've done such an incredible job at illustrating what North Korea looks like, what shaped it, and most importantly, what some of the lessons are that we can learn about that we can reflect upon ourselves and our own lives, which is exactly what you did in our last conversation. Brandon Gauthier, thank you so, so much for joining me and taking this time. I'm so appreciative and absolutely love having you on the podcast.
I'm grateful for Preconceived. I'm grateful for conversations that you hold that I think make the world a more nuanced place, even as we demand of ourselves that we make decisions, that we come to points of view about what is right or wrong. So I'm deeply enamored of what it is you do. And I think it's important, more important than ever, for the state of the world that we're living in today.
Thank you, Brandon. And you should definitely, definitely check out Brandon's book, Before Evil, Young Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, and Kim. It's his first book. Check it out. I read it in just a couple of sittings. It's fantastic. You can buy it on Amazon, and you can just look up Brandon Gauthier online, and I'll put that in the episode notes. Brandon, thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Zale.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.